You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. On today's show, Russia's Air Force furnishes some American sailors in the Baltic with some splendid photo opportunities. But how serious and how sensible is buzzing warships with fighter planes? My guests Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories from Germany and China and this guy again.
I'm not a fan of Megyn Kelly. I don't like her. She probably doesn't like me, and that's okay. But she better be fair.
As Donald Trump reportedly buries the hatchet with Fox News, we'll be asking where politicians should draw the line with media companies who don't necessarily serve their agenda. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, among others. Welcome both. We will start with this week's hijinks by the Russian Air Force, whose pilots have been amusing themselves by buzzing US warships in the Baltic Sea. The closest reported encounter saw a brace of Russian Su-24s swooping within 30 feet of the American guided missile destroyer USS Donald Cook. The aircraft were apparently unarmed, but U.S. officials described their behavior as, in inverted commas, a simulated attack profile. Michael, first of all, this is all obviously good fun and games until someone loses an eye. There have been a number of such incidents this week, especially centered around the USS Donald Cook. So one assumes that this is an order from on high rather than just bored pilots. What would be the strategic imperative as far as Russia's concerned?
Well, it's to make it clear that they don't want American ships patrolling off the coast of what they still regard as their backyard, the former Soviet Union, the Baltic states, even though they are, of course, members now of the European Union. And that American snooping...
And of NATO,
and
more...
And NATO, indeed. Well, that's probably the more important aspect of it, yes. Attempt to buzz them is simply an intimidatory tactic to try to show that the Russians are there and are going to take whatever measures they think necessary to shoo the Americans away. Well, it's psychological games, nothing more, because until they actually fire a weapon, it doesn't really matter how close you come to a ship, though, as you say, the potential for something going wrong is quite high. But it is part of an old game that both sides used to play in the Cold War days, of buzzing each other's aircraft, going into each other's airspace, just trying to provoke the other into some sort of reaction without actually taking military action.
I have to say, Sebastian, myself, I've never quite understood the point of these theatrics, because obviously both sides know exactly where the other one is and pretty much exactly what the leaderships of each other's countries or alliances think about the world. This does seem to be taking a reasonably large amount of risk for not terribly much reward, doesn't it?
But Andrew, have you served in Her Majesty's Australian Navy or indeed Air Force?
I have served in none of my home country's armed forces.
There we are. Neither have I. So I think, well, Australian, in my case, German, of course, I think we don't quite get the psychology of these people. They must be fairly bored on the whole. they have very, very sophisticated weapons. I mean, weapons, but also sophisticated technology at their disposal. They want to try it out. I think that, there is an element. I don't want to downplay it, but I think there is an element of boys wanting to play with their toys.
I grew up on army bases in Australia, and I have spent a certain amount of time among soldiers of various nationalities in the field. I'm reasonably familiar with the mentality, and for that reason, I rather suspect, Michael, that the pilots, the sailors involved on all sides have been finding this absolutely hilarious fun.
Yes, I think in the same way that the pilots in the film Top Gun have quite a lot of fun chasing each other and coming as close as they can to buzzing each other. It is a question of judgment, nerve, skills, see if you can do it. It's high risk, there is an element of intimidation, but I think both sides know that it's sort of theatrics rather than actual real military engagement.
And Sebastian, I'm trying to be optimistic about this. Does the fact that Russia is willing to send Su-24s within 30 feet or about 9 meters of a US destroyer, it actually betokens a certain amount of trust on both sides, doesn't it? Because the Russians are trusting the Americans not to do anything daft. They're trusting the Americans to recognize that these aircraft are not armed, that they're not actually a threat, and not to overreact. And there was a lovely interview, in fact, worth looking up in the Navy Times, the US Navy's official publication, where they spoke to a retired commanding officer about these situations, and his quote, which I most liked, was, "You don't get to kill people just because they're being annoying."
There we are. You know a lot more than about these things than I thought. Great. absolutely. The serious point here is we have NATO allies who we are bound to defend if attacked. Now, they have been asking the allies from Great Britain to Germany to whoever, but particularly the Americans, to come and be where the problems may arise. And so the fact that the Americans are there is clearly on demand of the Baltic states there. And as you say, I mean, there is still, I hope and trust, some degree of understanding what you can and what you can't do. And so far, it seems to me interesting, but on the whole, harmless fun.
Michael, I guess a final point on this. It's instructive to look at the way the same incidents are being reported by Russian media. I quote the first line of RT's report, in which they said the aerobatic skills of Russian pilots over the US destroyer Donald Cook in the Baltic Sea left the Pentagon and other US officials running for cover in Washington. Is there a level at which this is theatre constructed for a domestic audience in Russia, and does it really impress anybody?
It might be, but unless RT or anyone reports it, how will the domestic audience in Russia really know what's been going on? They're not out there to see it.
Indeed,
I suppose
not.
Social media will have it and they will get that. But nowadays, it's not so easy. It's not as easy as it used to be for Russian audiences to see what the Russian leadership doesn't want them to see. They can't prevent information coming through in the way they could in the old Cold War days. But I don't think this would be constructed really just for domestic consumption. If it is going to be seen, the message has to be, look how the West is threatening us still. Look, they're sending their ships right to the coastline of our continent, if not our country. Look at the Western intimidatory tactics. We're up there, our brave boys will defend us. And that's the sort of message, perhaps, that they think will be picked up in Russia, if it is.
We should also, in fairness, there was an American RC-135U surveillance aircraft was seen off by Russian fighters near Kaliningrad last week. So there's a bit of both going
on
here.
Oh, yes. Well, a surveillance aircraft is a lot more serious because that will be spying. That will be taking pictures of Russian troops across the border, of positions where they may have got military emplacements and things of that kind. And that's the point of it.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Germany and its ongoing attempts to deal with the migrants and refugees it welcomed last summer before it became apparent that the migrants and refugees weren't necessarily quite as welcome as Germany's leaders might have hoped. A bunch of measures unveiled today seek a balance between integrating new arrivals and placating those, rather, who might prefer to see them depart. Among other measures, migrants granted residence rights will be required to learn the language, and their access to benefits will be contingent on their seeking work. Sebastian, Chancellor Angela Merkel says that this contains an offer for everyone, but duties for everyone, which is fair enough, isn't it?
I think so. It sounds like Tony Blair, doesn't it? The third way. rights and responsibilities. Absolutely. I mean, you summed it up in a nutshell. There are plenty of people there willing to integrate, I think. There's quite extraordinary demand after language courses, for example. No doubt about it. And a shortage of qualified language teachers.
Just to follow it up generally, though, in terms of the German political scene now, how much pressure is she still under over this issue?
She is. The pressure is still there. I mean, of course, the pressure has eased slightly because of something which Merkel, according to herself, doesn't like, namely the sealing off of the Balkan route. She's been very critical of the Austrians and the Serbs, etc. But in fact, they saved her bacon. I have no doubt because the tremendous wave of people coming in has been diminished to a trickle, 30,000 last month, which is nothing. Which
compared to last summer, it is a dramatic reduction.
Yeah.
Michael, just generally, not just in Germany, but I guess across Europe, do you think there has been? I mean, prior to the beginning of the migration crisis, immigration was always discussed, or largely discussed, as if it was a one-way thing. There was discussion was about rights which should be arrogated to immigrants. There was very little discussion of what responsibilities were incumbent upon new arrivals. Is that something that got forgotten, do you think?
Possibly. The language question is central to this. And
yeah.
I don't think it's been forgotten in Britain, because there has been a lot of discussion about migrants who've been here for a very long time, one or two generations, particularly from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent, whose families do not speak English. And it's particularly, of course, the women in the families, because quite often men settle in northern Britain, say, and they bring over brides from Pakistan, and they deliberately don't let them learn English in order to keep them within the community. That's the suspicion. I mean, that's obviously not the entire case, but there have been cases of that. And there's been quite a lot of talk about the fact that anybody who lives in Britain must learn the language. Otherwise, you will never get integration. And for Germany, that's absolutely the same story. And it's absolutely clear that anybody living in Germany, even if they speak perfect English, must learn German, because German is the language of the country, and that's where you're going to live. So you must learn the language of the country in which you wish to live.
That said, I have many English friends who have moved to Germany in recent years in search of cheaper rents and a better life, who tell me that it's the worst place in the world to try and learn German if you already speak English, because as soon as you try to speak to a German in German, they'll just reply in English because they speak it better than... Actually, they probably speak it better than you speak English, never mind better than you speak German. But Sebastian...
You're flattering.
Sebastian, in general, how good is Germany at accommodating, absorbing, integrating new arrivals, and I guess extending German national identity to people who want to make a life there?
Well, look, that I think that this new law, this initiative, which hasn't quite become a law yet, is obviously based on the history of the last 40, 50 years. What Germany brought in from the late 50s, what were called Gastarbeiter, guest workers. In other words, very much the fiction that you can bring in people and their whole families, and they will leave. Well, they don't leave, of course, because they put down roots. They get friends. They become to all they become Germans, integrating. Some better, some worse. I think there's been over the last 20 years an acknowledgement of that. Then the Red-Green coalition in the 90s, early 2000s, brought in laws which made it much easier to get German citizenship. Indeed, also have the binational citizenship, which was one of the problems with Turkey, because Turkey insisted on people keeping their citizenship. And now, I mean, look at our national team. It's been in football, it's transformed over the last 10 years, because we have finally made an effort to integrate what the Swiss call secondos. In other words, people who are second and indeed third generation immigrants, who, but to all extents and purposes, are Germans. They speak it. They've grown up in the school system, but they didn't have the passport. That was a ludicrous situation, and it's been changed. All for the better, I would have thought.
Michael, the new measures that the German government has unveiled also contain new counter-terrorism measures, laws on intelligence sharing, that kind of thing. Just wondering about the political optics of treating that or regarding that as an immigration issue. Is that a deliberate sop to that portion of the German electorate which is not necessarily convinced as yet?
It could be. It could be a way of saying, well, if you are worried that some of these immigrants aren't really immigrants, are indeed people masquerading as refugees, and they are terrorists intent on committing murder and mayhem, as indeed we saw with the case of one or two who went to Belgium, here is what we're going to do to strengthen internal security. The two shouldn't necessarily be linked, but in many people's minds they are. And if you're going to set out a law about the way that newcomers must adapt, then equally it's reassuring to set out a law saying, and we'll do this in safety for the rest of the country. But it's also necessary, whether or not the immigrants are coming, to have better intelligence sharing with other countries and better intelligence on terrorism, which is a key electoral worry across Europe.
Final thought from you on this one, Sebastian. It's coming up for a year now, I guess, since those dreadful photos of that poor kid, Aylin Kurdi, had a transformative effect, I think, on public opinion of the immigration crisis or the migrant and refugee crisis. We saw that extraordinary act of generosity by Germany, sort of welcoming in upwards of 1 million people. How do you think Germans feel about that now? Are people still proud of that? Are they starting to wonder if they got a little bit carried away? Where is the public mood?
It was transformative in Britain as well, wasn't it? Because Britain decided, rather than taking in 486, the country could now take in 20,000 over 5 years, yes.
Fair point.
I think, on the whole, people are still happy with that initial response, but I think more people than used to do in August and September now acknowledge that Angela Merkel should have said, we are a welcoming country, but there are obligations and there are limits to our hospitality. And I think she had to learn a hard lesson without ever saying as much. But on the whole, I think the people have stayed with her.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. Coming up next, Quis Custodiet Ipsos Custodes, or the Chinese equivalent thereof.
Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference returns this April for 3 days of great conversations, inspiring panellists and peerless hosting. Set in Vienna, the conference will pull together people who care about running better businesses, brands, design studios, cities and even nations, and who are looking for global inspiration and new benchmarks for success. Up for discussion will be the future of communication in a world overwhelmed by digital content, how to make a nation. Monocle is launching this brand new book in Austria and will be bringing some star names from diplomacy, government and business to explain how good countries can deliver on quality of life for all. And we'll hear from players from around the globe who've discovered that you can create jobs and wealth with downtown ateliers and the sound of the odd hammer. Speakers such as chef and food writer Bill Granger, co-founder and director of Vienna Design Week Lily Holein, and the journalist and writer Gianni Riotta will share the stage with Monocle's editors and many, many more. Running from Friday afternoon to Sunday, with a focus on a full Saturday schedule, the conference is designed as a live event with elements broadcast here on Monocle 24. In between the debates, there'll be plenty of time to meet the editors, speakers, sponsors, and also your fellow readers and listeners. For more information and tickets, visit monocle.com. Be part of the discussion at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2016 from April 15th to the 17th. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. Now, it is a fabulous irony, almost certainly an unsolvable problem, but there are few greater temptations to corruption than being placed in charge of policing it. This is a line that might be tried on the judge by a Chinese graft inspector put under investigation late last year, who now faces prosecution over accusations that he trousered slightly over $200,000 in bribes. Fang Qiyu, and there is nominative determinism terrorism in action right there, had been deputy chief of one of the anti-corruption teams sent across the country by Xi Jinping, president of China, who has made cleaning house his signature policy. Michael, the Communist Party continues to insist that it, and only it, can root out corruption. It doesn't need to appoint an independent body or anything insane like that. Is the Communist Party, though, just too much part of the problem to be any part of the solution?
Yes, of course it is. It's been the ruling elite for well over 60 years. And as a result, it has very few actual constitutional or even practical controls on its own affairs. It polices itself, it decides the law, it makes the law, and when things go wrong, it is meant to clean up. Well, if you appoint an independent body, then you're effectively denying the monopoly of power of the Communist Party, which has been a fundamental basis of communist systems throughout the world ever since they were set up. So I think there's great reluctance to have outsiders come in and do anything. And also, there's a question of face. The idea that the Communist Party is somehow riddled with corruption, which everybody knows, is a very difficult one to admit.
Because it is riddled with corruption in the way that any single organisation which has been in a position of uncontested power for 60 years is going to be.
Of course, yes, that's the problem. And that's why. And added to that, you've got this extraordinary bonanza in wealth, which means the temptations are 10 times more than they ever were for the first 20 or 30 or even 40 years of communism, when the pickings were much smaller. But now you can become fabulously rich with a few bribes and payoffs and underhand dealings. You can make more money than people could ever have dreamed of.
Sebastian, again, I'm trying to be optimistic. I'm clearly in an extremely sunny mood this evening. And I just wanted to mention Mr. Fang Qiu's name again, because it's not getting old. Does it at least tell us something good that the reason we know about Mr. Fang Qiu's alleged misdemeanors, that it was reported in Xinhua? This has been reported in official state media, which you can imagine might not have been the case 10 or 20 years ago.
But isn't it part of, I'm really not a China specialist, but isn't it part of the picture that we've been seeing emerging over the last 2 years since the new president took power, that he's constantly going on about the fight against corruption? And increasingly, China buffs point out that, funnily enough, all the factions within the Communist Party who aren't on his side are particularly riddled with corruption and therefore need to be strongly punished, and for reasons unknown, the president emerges as a shining star and has I think acquired more powers than at least two of his predecessors. So I'm afraid I am slightly cynical about the whole thing, because we all know that corruption in China is a daily occurrence, and whatever Western businessmen tell you in looking into your eyes and saying, I've never encountered it, I doubt it very much.
Well, there is still gloomy news, which is that the official newspaper of the anti-corruption agency, which is the Discipline, Inspection and Supervision News, has this week announced that golf is now permissible for Chinese Communist Party members again, it having been banned briefly in 2015. Step in the wrong direction.
You are in a very sunny mood.
No, I mean, honestly, that was such a potential step forward.
A great leap,
one could even say. But no, they have regressed abjectly there. We should move on to our final story tonight, because we have but days to go until the New York primary, and Donald Trump appears to be attempting to cultivate a slightly more urbane demeanour before facing his hometown voters. The centrepiece of his charm offensive has been agreeing to a meeting with Megyn Kelly, the Fox News presenter who had been the subject of some of Trump's more crassly misogynist outbursts during the campaign. Trump subsequently lunched with Fox chairman Roger Ailes. Let's remind ourselves of how Trump and Kelly fell out in the first place.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president?
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. And frankly, what I say, and oftentimes it's fun, it's kidding, we have a good time, what I say is what I say.
There's a Republican debate Thursday night. Fox is hosting that debate. You and Megyn Kelly have had issues. She's one of the moderators. Are you going to be at that Fox debate?
I'm not a fan of Megyn Kelly. I don't like her. She probably doesn't like me, and that's okay. But she better be fair. I'd like to go to the debate. I enjoy the debates. I've done well in the debates. Every single poll has said I've won every debate. But we're going to see what happens. Going to be exciting.
Michael, for all that Donald Trump is an absolute nailed-on certainty to win in New York on Tuesday, you can I've looked it up, you can barely put a bet on him. But is he deciding, perhaps looking a bit beyond that, that maybe he does need the media slightly more than he might have thought he did?
Well, if he is, it's about time. I mean, the idea that he could get even as far as he has got with the kind of behaviour...
is extraordinary, and about which I and many others have been consistently 100% flat wrong.
Yes, and so has everyone. Well, I think Trump has now found that the realities, in the end, come down to bear on you, and that if the press is as alienated and hostile as large sections of it are, they are going to be encouraging those factions in the Republican Party, and that's essentially most of them, that wants somehow to sabotage Trump's chances at the last moment and to make it so that you have a brokered convention where you will not get an overwhelming victory by Trump. And he needs to break that kind of consensus that Trump's a nutter and a bad case. And the only way to do that is to begin to woo a few people who write stuff in the media or blog or tweet or whatever to your side.
Sebastian, the relationship between politics and media is relentlessly picked apart in the United States and to a slightly lesser extent here in Britain. And indeed, this week, one of the big stories has been this John Whittingdale scandal, this absolute non-story, which is I don't even know where to start with it. It is so many levels of trivia and inanity that my nose bleeds if I start thinking about it, so I won't. But is it different in Germany? Presumably, politicians and the media have a relationship, but is it as fractious as it tends to be in Britain and the United States?
But is it fractious?
That's actually, now that I think of it, a very good question.
I wonder about that sometimes. I mean, in Britain, everybody pretends to be at each other's throat, but it, in the end, I don't know whether that's actually true. In Germany, of course, we have the Springer publishing house, which traditionally has been very strong, particularly because of the... Bild-Zeitung, the large tabloid, the largest tabloid in Europe, I believe, and lots of people have worshipped at the altar of Bild-Zeitung, and it's been very interesting to see occasionally people slightly moving away from that, and I think generally, of course, that the good thing about social media is that these kind of media like Springer have lost some of their influence, and it's...
But what about with politicians? I mean, everyone reads tabloids still in Germany and in Britain, but the question is whether the politicians themselves are in a fractious relationship or in an adversarial relationship. And I got the impression when I lived in Germany that actually there was a lot of cozying up.
Too much.
The politicians and the press cooked up what tomorrow's story was going to be. And in fact, one correspondent of a local newspaper in Bonn was simply known as Pravda because he just he wrote what he was told to write.
I think the mores have changed slightly since the move to Berlin, and also that there's been tougher investigative journalism recently. But there's still too much cozying, no doubt about it. I mean, interviews in Germany, you have to go back to the politician and let them look at it, which I find extraordinary.
We will have to leave it there. Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion, thank you both very much as ever for joining us on Midori House. That is all for today's episode thereof. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilse Viveros. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.